All right, everybody, welcome back. Holden Karnofsky is here. He is the executive director of the Open Philanthropy Project, an organization that identifies outstanding giving opportunities, makes grants, follows the results, and publishes its findings. Holden co-founded GiveWell in 2007 and began co-developing the Open Philanthropy Project, which was initially called GiveWell Labs, starting in 2012. Please join me in welcoming for a fireside chat with Will McCaskill, Holden Karnofsky. And again, welcome back to the stage, your favorite philosophy professor and mine, Will McCaskill. Ooh, careful.
Oh, thanks for all attending. And as before, don't forget to submit questions on Bizabo. And I'll, especially if the questions seem good and are relevant to the conversation we're having at the time, I'll kind of thread them into the chat I'm having with Holden just now. So, starting off, I mean, most people in the audience I expect to know, but just tell us a bit about Open Philanthropy Project, your background and your focus areas.
Sure. So the Open Philanthropy Project is an organization that makes grants to do as much good as possible. And then share what we're thinking and what we're finding to help other philanthropists give as well as they can. We started as part of GiveWell. We started several years ago when we met Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz. Dustin's one of the co-founders of Facebook as well as Asana. And they were kind of facing a situation where they were trying to give away a very large fortune, billions of dollars, over the course of their lives, and wanted to figure out how to do it as well as possible. And we had a lot of conversations and eventually started working more closely together. We moved GiveWell from New York to San Francisco to work more closely with them. And that grew into the Open Philanthropy Project. So in terms of our evolution, what we've done to date, our first few years were really trying to find a basic framework, just getting our footing. And then in 2014, we spent most of the year choosing causes, finding areas that we thought were important, neglected, and tractable to focus the funding on. And then in 2015, we really spent most of the year just hiring and trying to build the team we needed to give in those causes. And then in 2016 was the first year that we really focused on grant making. And so in just to give a sense of scale, in 2015, grant making was about $15 million, but in 2016, it was over $100 million. And so that's sort of where we're at now. And our focus areas, basically, we're always trying to do as much good as possible. A lot of times that can't, in theory, we would love to calculate how much good every grant does per dollar. In practice, we often take shortcuts. So we've tried to pick causes that are important, neglected, and tractable. And the way that we've done that is we've done like little investigations on a lot of causes and picked the ones that seem most promising. And the things we work on right now, there's a bunch of things, but the biggest focus areas by far, criminal justice reform, which we think is a U.S. issue where there's kind of unusual room to get some policy wins that could make the world better off. Farm animal welfare, I think people here will be familiar with, definitely trying to improve the treatment of animals who are treated incredibly cruelly and incredible numbers on factory farms. Biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. So this is kind of trying to prevent worst-case pandemics, the kind of thing that would be, one of my best guesses for what would wipe out humanity if anything did. And finally, potential risks from advanced artificial intelligence, which probably most people here have heard about, and that's sort of trying to plan ahead for what might happen if there's a dramatically powerful, world-changing AI and how we can make sure that, doesn't go badly. So those are our main focus areas.
Okay, thanks. And, tell us a bit about some of the challenges you faced over those few years of Plan Operate Open Phil.
Sure. Early on, a lot of it was just trying to know where to start and have a framework and, realizing that we couldn't calculate the good accomplished by everything and we needed to find ways to kind of approximate and be systematic and be ambitious without losing some of the important intuitions we had. Now I would say things are pretty different. So this is the first time that we're really giving it scale. And we're, if you made a list of major grant makers, we would be somewhere on that list. We're kind of a major foundation now. And so this year, our main goal and our main focus is kind of about building a more polished operation in many respects. So everything from our operations team, we're currently searching for a director of operations, everything from our grant-making process, and then on the more intellectual side, having a better framework for evaluating ourselves, having a better plan for how we're going to know how things are going now that we finally have some grants to look back on, and then also trying to get more systematic about really having a framework for how we decide how much money goes to each cause. Because so far, the goal has been kind of find good things to do, give to whatever we find that looks good, and now we need to start thinking about what happens when we start running up against budgets. And so a lot of that is that, you know, last year it was all about trying to see how many good grants we could make. This year is about continuing the grant making, but trying to see if we can become a really well-run organization in every way that kind of has systematically thought-through approaches to everything we do. And I think I want to do that before we do the next round of expansion, because we are going to look to grow grant making a great deal from here as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. And so one thing you mentioned as a challenge was, yeah, getting your operations really good. And one thing I think a lot of people don't see kind of from the outside is just, I have done from interacting with you, is just how well-run a ship it seems Open Philanthropy is, just
Thanks.
As an organization. And so can you talk a little bit about your kind of management philosophy, how you how you think about that, and how important is that to Open Phil?
Yeah, so we try to run the organization with a management philosophy of you know, I might summarize as trust but verify. So the ideal way, I think, for Open Philanthropy to run is that we'd have phenomenal people with a huge amount of autonomy. Because I, you know, if I had to be the one to figure out every grant, whether it was good, I think that would not go well. And I think it's much better if we have program officers who know their field 100 times better than I do, and they have autonomy and they have trust, and they can do things that may not 100% be convincing to me, but that because I trust them, I'm able to stand behind them, and then Carrie and Dustin are able to stand behind them too. So that's the ideal. And so it's a very people-based philosophy. It's all about, you know, having great people that we believe in and giving them freedom to do their work. But in order to get there, we need to make sure we have the right people in the right roles, and that because the nature of our work is very kind of fuzzy and hard to evaluate, because the metrics don't come prepackaged, we need to invest very heavily in that process of figuring out who should be in what role, who are the best people for us to hire, and what role should they be in. And so there we get very intensive. And so a lot of times, actually, I think of us as a people-based organization that gives people autonomy, but a lot of new employees kind of feel the opposite way. They just feel that they're being inundated with questions. Just, you know, when we'll hire someone who's an expert in their field, knows far more than I do, and they'll get a zillion questions from me and others just every day. And the reason that we're doing it that way is because we are trying to, you know, basically obsess over everyone's strengths and weaknesses and what role everyone should be in. And that's what I think of as my job. That's my real job. And so, you know, I like learning about the topics we do, farm animal welfare, AI, but usually my goal is just learn enough that I can start to figure out whom to trust. And so, you know, generally the topic I obsess about the most is what are everyone's strengths and weaknesses and how can I learn more about that? And when people are new, especially, we put just a ton of work into what assignments can we give that will help us learn more about what people are good at and what they aren't. And we do have a pretty intensive management style. So, you know, everyone has a definite manager. There are regular check-ins. It's almost never less than once a week. And our hiring is pretty intense, too. So there's more than one role where we've had a search going for an entire year or more. Because we would just rather hire no one than hire someone who we're not really excited about and ready to take a bet on. So that's the basic trust but verify approach we try to have.
Cool. Okay, and then something that's been striking for me is it seems like you've just updated, you've changed your views quite a lot over the past, certainly over the past decade and also over the past few years. And I'm interested in kind of what drove that. Were there any big realization, some like epiphany moment, or was it an accumulation of small little updates?
Yeah.
And maybe talk about the ways in which you changed your mind as well.
Sure. So I've changed my mind a lot, I've kind of documented a lot of it in pretty exhaustive detail. So if anyone wants to read way more than you should want to know about why I've changed my mind. There's a blog post called Three Key Issues I've Changed My Mind About, and there's another post I made on the Effective Altruism Forum called Some Thoughts on Public Discourse that really describes the evolution of my thinking on transparency and sharing information with the public and what the costs and benefits of that are and who should do it and how much. So certainly I've documented a lot of mind changes. I think that's important to do because we are doing things incredibly differently from how I'd be doing them as, you know, as the person I used to be. And I think it's important that people understand that and not get confused. In terms of epiphanies versus little things, honestly, there's been both. One big moment for me for sure. There's this topic of potential risk from advanced AI. I was very skeptical of that for many years. I was skeptical of it. I mostly felt that the people who seemed best positioned to understand the issues, which were sort of academic computer scientists, they didn't seem interested. And I kind of assumed that there must be some good argument there that I didn't know, but that if I looked long enough, I would find it. A good argument for being dismissive of these risks of advanced AI. And so I didn't take the issue seriously, and I didn't take the, you know, the people advocating for it very seriously either in many cases. And so certainly in 2015, after the release of Superintelligence, and when there was the letter signed by the Puerto Rico conference, you know, it wasn't, I mean, I think it still wasn't clear what academic mainstream folks actually thought, but what I did see was just a turning on a dime. What I saw was just, you know, people had been saying, let's dismiss this. Then people were signing a letter saying, we're for this. I was getting a much better sense of the discourse and what people had to say about the arguments in Superintelligence. And that was kind of a big dramatic, you know, update for me of saying, hey, I don't think the arguments are there. I think this is one of the most important issues in the world. Boy, that seems like a big thing to have missed. And also now I got to take another look at a bunch of other beliefs that were feeding into that. And, you know, who are the people who were kind of early advocating for this topic? Because I should probably talk to them more and think about them more. And so a whole bunch of things changed at once. And I talk about that in my three key issues post. But there's been other topics where it's just been more slow. I'll have some background view about the way the world works. And that view leads me to expect to see constant confirmation of the view. And every once in a while, I'm just like, boy, I'm not seeing any confirmation of this view. Maybe I should change it. And that stuff is much harder to track down, but I've certainly tried.
Cool. Okay. And so as in the course of this updating, how much then has, you know, how deep are the disagreements, if any, within OpenPhil between, or disagreements between you and Carrie and Dustin, or are you pretty unified?
Sure. So, you know, on one hand, OpenPhil, we try to have a culture that really encourages and welcomes disagreement between, you know, anyone at any level of the organization, because we want everyone to give their input and we want to be able to consider what they're saying. On another hand, you know, we do have this kind of trust but verify culture. And so when two people are very different in terms of their level of detail or their level of engagement, you might not see a lot of active disagreement between them, or not as much as you would see between people who kind of work on the same topic at the same level of detail. So, for example, a program officer who might be an expert in criminal justice or biosecurity or farm animal welfare, a lot of times when they aren't making sense to me, I'll just say, I defer to you. And so, and I think I have a similar relationship with Carrie and Dustin, where a lot of times I'm more in the weeds, I've got my head in it, we'll talk for a while, but if it's kind of hard to work through the argument, there is a default of deferring. And so in that sense, you may not see a lot of, you know, a lot of really dramatic disagreements. That said, and certainly I think we're extremely value aligned. Carrie and Dustin, I think, are really bought into the idea of doing as much good as possible. That's what they're passionate about. And so we really do see eye to eye on a lot of things. Certainly it's not exactly, we're not doing exactly what we would be doing if it were my money. One example of that is a lot of times if there's a grant that's really just all about the person, it's just 100% a trust play, and the case for the grant on the merits is very hard to make. Those will be times when I'm closer to the situation, I know the people, I've spent more time on it, and it's going to be hard for Carrie and Dustin to have the same level of buy-in. So examples of this, discretionary budgets for program officers, they have them, how big should they be? Also, you know, the idea has come up of creating re-granting pools. So saying, you know, here's an individual, it would be really interesting if they did philanthropy, why don't we create a re-granting fund for them? Those are both ideas where it's just, you know, I'm often closer to the people, closer to the situation, and there's not the same level of buy-in from Carrie and Dustin, and so that's a thing that we work on. And, you know, of course, there's the constant... At OpenPhil, there's constant disagreements on all sorts of things, and a lot of times I disagree with myself, and so, you know, some of the classic topics for that would, for example, be how we want to weigh some of these more speculative, theoretical, high-risk areas we work in versus some of the more tangible ones.
Okay, cool. And so then, what are some of the big, you know, wins that you've had, do you think, in the past? So you're pursuing this idea of hits-based giving. You expect most grants not to pay off.
Yep.
So I guess both, how are you evaluating this at the moment, or intend to evaluate this in the future? And then are there cases already where you think, yeah, I've really made a lot of progress in this area, and we can verify that?
Yep. So one of the challenges of evaluation is that OpenPhil has this hits-based giving philosophy, which says that we think a lot of the best grants are going to be the kind of thing where you make 10 grants, 9 of them are a total failure and just kind of look silly in retrospect, and one of them is a huge success that justifies everything else. And it's kind of a venture capital style philosophy, and I think if you look at past philanthropic wins, I think you can see some that are big enough to justify a lot of failures. So it's important to us to be able to do things that, A, you know, it may be hard to argue the case, it may be a high-risk thing to do, also to do things that might take a long time to work, and things where we may never know if we had an impact. And so we need to be open to all kinds of sort of, you know, maybe high expertise grants that are, by their nature, just very hard to evaluate or take a very long time. And so because of that, we don't want to have a very draconian sort of algorithmic system of having metrics on our grants, because we think that will put us in a straitjacket where people only make grants that you can clearly justify, and that will keep us away from some of the big potential wins. That's a challenge for us. So far, the thing that we've tried to do, and I will say, everything is too new to say a ton about this. But 2016 was our first year with a lot of giving. We don't have a lot of grants that are old enough to say much about. But, you know, so far the approach has been to emphasize making clear predictions, setting out expectations. When you make a grant, there's an internal write-up that everyone has to fill out. The person suggesting the grant fills out the write-up. And it includes questions like, what would make this grant a success? What are you hoping for? How will we decide whether to renew? It also includes a question, are you willing to make any time-bound probabilistic predictions about this grant, such as 80% chance that they'll hire the person they're trying to hire, such as 20% chance that they'll get this policy win, and then we can look back. And so what that does is it means that when we read the write-up, we can all get on the same page and we can say, this grant, we're expecting results, or that grant, we're just never going to know. And then when we look back, we can compare what we've learned to what we actually thought was going to happen. And so far, our main approach to evaluation is it's kind of the opposite of one size fits all. It's, you know, trying to give ourselves a lot of leeway to treat every grant differently, and instead sort of say, let's just be clear about what we're aiming for, what we're expecting, and then we'll look back and evaluate the grant on its own terms. You asked if we had wins. I think we do. In fact, I would say we have more wins than I would have expected, for sure. I think it's a little early for someone working on long time horizons like this to expect much, but I think the farm animal work has really succeeded way beyond what I would have predicted, and especially much faster. So when we started our farm animal program, there were these corporate campaigns that had a couple big wins, getting like a major fast food chain to pledge to go cage-free in all its eggs. And we kind of came in and said, how much can you scale up and speed up these campaigns? And very shortly afterward, basically almost every major grocer and every major fast food company in the U.S. has made a pledge to go cage-free. Then we started taking it international. There have been a whole bunch of corporate pledges there. Also moving on to broiler welfare, have been getting some wins there. So I definitely don't want to give the impression we think this is all because of our funding. I think some of it was inevitable. Some of the hardest wins were already in place when we came in, and there is something of a domino effect. But, you know, I would say that is an area where I was surprised. I think we at least sped things up, and it's been very exciting to just see, you know, animal advocates going after corporations, getting pledges that we think are just going to affect huge numbers of animals, make their lives better, and the cost effectiveness of that per dollar looks really good. And I think could justify a lot of the rest of our portfolio not going so well, if that's kind of how it comes to. On criminal justice reform, you know, I would say we've seen a couple of early wins. Some of them are small. There was a major bill in Illinois, bipartisan, big reduction in incarceration, that we believe would have been very unlikely to happen without our funding, and came, you know, major involvement from the Alliance for Safety and Justice, which is basically our biggest bet in criminal justice reform, and we're their major funder. And, you know, I think that program is not yet at the point where we have, like, enough wins to justify the program. I think that's on a slightly longer timeline, but I think the early signs that it could are there. And then some of our other programs, you know, we look for intermediate signs that things are going well. We ask, are we helping to grow for AI safety? We ask, are we helping to grow the field? Are there more people working on this than a year ago? But in terms of actual wins, in terms of this made the world better, I don't have anything to report on some of those longer term or X-risk focused causes yet.
Okay, great. And then one question from the audience is, 5 years' time, what are your kind of aims for open philanthropy?
Sure. So I would say I'll maybe answer it a year at a time or so. I mean, I would hope that in a year or two, that I feel that we're just very systematic and excellent at everything we do. So I think so far we've been very pragmatic. We picked causes, we hired people, we've brought up our grant making. But I also want it to be the case that we have really thought through everything about how much budget goes to each area, which we haven't done yet, how we evaluate ourselves. Our operations team should be really smooth. Our grants payments process should be, I think, better than it is. And so that's like step one in a year or two. And then what I would hope is that at that point, we're sort of aiming to be, in a sense, a role model philanthropic organization, that every aspect of our work, from choosing the causes, choosing the grants, choosing the people, executing the grants, we're doing it kind of as well as we could sort of hope to. And then I think the focus becomes twofold. One is we need to scale up our giving more. And two is I think if and when we do become a role model, we want to put more effort into helping other philanthropists do better work. And so 5 years from now, I think we would hopefully see the beginnings of that. I think we would see that we're, you know, starting to engage a lot with other people getting started in their philanthropy. And maybe by then we're getting close or we're about to get close to sort of peak giving that we're aiming for, which would be several times our current giving. And I hope maybe in more like 10 years that, you know, the giving is as high as it's going to get. And also that we're having a big influence on how everyone is thinking about giving, especially people who are just starting off and can kind of do it anyway.
Okay, cool. And then in terms of the relationship between Open Phil and the EA community, I mean, it's obviously a really big issue for the EA community that now there's, you know, billions of dollars of potential funding, are very aligned in terms of values with most of the core people in EA. Do you think that given that there's still like a role for people to be going and earning to give, or do you think that's just not a useful thing for people to be doing now?
Yeah, I definitely think there's a role for earning to give. I think that's for a few reasons. One, everyone has blind spots, and we're an institution, and we're going to miss a lot of things. So I think it's, you know, as someone giving who's very engaged and looking hard for the best opportunities, I absolutely expect people to find things that we miss. And then another thing is that, you know, funders play an important role for nonprofits. They're one of the main sources of accountability. If the management is kind of, you know, maybe losing their edge or not fulfilling the mission of the organization anymore, a lot of times that is who has the actual ability to, you know, impose some accountability. So for us to be the only funder, for example, of all the effective altruist orgs, I think would be a very bad thing, and it would be unhealthy. I think there needs to be more diversity in that funding base there for sure. And a lot of times we just refuse to fund, let's say, more than half of an organization because we don't want to be just like running the place, you know, in terms of accountability when we don't have the time to engage in that. So we prefer a, you know, a diversified base of donors holding accountable. So I think, yeah, we definitely don't want to be the only effective altruist funder. I will say on earning to give that I do think that the kind of talent gaps to me look more dire and pressing and red hot than the funding gaps right now, for sure. And I'll also say that the donors I'm most excited about are the ones who are really dialed in and very serious and pay a lot of attention. I think those are the ones who have the ability to fill some of these roles I'm talking about. And so if I were thinking about earning to give, I would be more excited about having a chance of becoming a massive, very engaged donor than I would be about just kind of giving a medium amount and paying a little bit of attention every year. And for that reason, you know, I think this donor lottery idea that Carl Shulman and Paul Cristiano have put together is very interesting because it lets you actually make that trade. So you can say, you know, I am giving away a modest amount, but instead I can sort of play this donor lottery and one person is going to end up giving away a large amount and they can take it really seriously and the rest of us can save our time. So I think that's a pretty interesting idea and something to think about.
Okay, cool. And then continuing on relationship between EA and OpenPhil, like a question from the audience is, what concerns do you have about the EA community?
What concerns do I have about the EA community?
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, I think the EA community is like a tremendous force for good overall, in my opinion. I think that, you know, one of the things that is tough is that we know we're affiliated with the EA community. And so whatever message becomes associated with EA, we always have to worry a little bit about, you know, how that might affect how people perceive us. And that can be important. You know, we're certainly optimizing for doing good, not optimizing for our brand, but also we need to hire people. We need to be partners with people. We want people to be excited to get funding from Open Philanthropy. So we certainly care about reputation. And so I think, yeah, there has been in EA a bit of a history of, you know, statements that might be arrogant or sound arrogant, that might be very extreme, statements about, you know, how some causes are just obviously better than others. I think that can be kind of a general current of effective altruist thinking of just, and I think in a funny way, I think there's a bit of confusion around it because I think a lot of effective altruists are trying to be humble and modest and they're trying to use a Bayesian framework. So instead of believing things are true or not true, they believe with probabilities. But then what they end up doing is that they'll put a probability on something and then multiply through by some other big number and end up deciding that actually there's only one decision that could possibly ever be justified, and it dominates all other decisions. And I think that, like, in a way, they're trying to be humble, but I think that when you act as though you've done the math and you have the answer and it's obvious what to do, I think that is perceived by many people as arrogance, and is arrogance, I think, you know, regardless of whether you were at 99% on any particular proposition. So that's something I watch out for sometimes, and I think another part, you know, another thing that comes with arrogance sometimes is giving any impression that you might be, you know, have an ends justify the means mentality. Like, for example, that you might be willing to deceive someone to get them to give more money. Open Philanthropy really tries to just build ourselves on, you know, trustworthiness and integrity and truth. Those come first. And we do impact as much as we can subject to those things. And I think that is what most effective altruists aspire to as well. And that's what I think they should.
Cool. And then what skills, again, a question from the audience, what things do you think are missing in the EA movement at the moment in terms of skills, areas of knowledge, gaps that people like in this room could be trying to fill?
Sure. Well, I certainly think there's a tremendous number of gaps. There's a lot of things we wish we could fund that we're not funding. Certainly on AI, people doing good work on AI strategy. I think that's a very thin field right now. Certainly on biosecurity and pandemic preparedness, people are focused on the worst cases. That's not where the field currently is at. I think that obviously wish there were more AI safety technical researchers. I wish the farm animal welfare movement were bigger, not just in terms of campaigners, but in terms of knowledge. A lot of these corporate campaigns, you need to know what to ask for. And so, you know, we've read these fascinating studies about what chickens prefer and how you figure that out. And, you know, will a chicken push a heavy door to get this kind of behavior or that kind of behavior? And I think I wish the research on what kind of lives chickens want were better. That would be useful. And so, you know, there's a whole bunch of things. But I think a common thread running through a lot of this is that I do think that the EA community is short on people who have a really deep, serious specialization and expertise. I think that often is what you need to do a lot of the things I'm saying and to do a lot of other things. And I also think the EA community seems to me sometimes to be a bit heavy on people whose favorite thing to do is sort of think and write and talk, all of which I think are very important and good, but maybe a little short on execution. So certainly when I look at who I wish we were funding, it's like, it would be really wonderful if there was just a lot of people who just, you know, they're top machine learning researchers, they're top pandemic preparedness people, they know their field, they know everything about it, they know everyone in it, and they do stuff, you know, consistently. And I think that's the kind of thing that I most wish there were more of.
Perfect. And this is cool. This is also very relevant to the theme of the conference, which is thinking like, not how do I do the most good, but how do we as a community do the most good, where that means like, yeah, taking integrity really seriously, because if you're giving, you're not just giving yourself a bad name, but the whole community. And then secondly, it's just starting to specialize, because we can benefit from division of labor and people getting peak.
I think there was a time when it made a little bit more sense to just say, here are some amazing ideas. Let's do whatever we can to get people to pay attention to them, you know? And I think I still want people doing that. I still think that's a good thing to do. But I think there's these sort of dire needs for certain kinds of execution now, too. Yeah. And a lot of that requires specialization.
Yeah. And, like, not everyone can be, like, a, you know, thinker.
That's right. Yeah.
These other skills are really valuable, too.
That's right.
So.
Yeah.
Okay, changing tack a little bit. Again, something's coming from the audience a bit is how what you feel like you've learned in terms of trying to influence government. So maybe giving a little bit of an overview of what sort of lobbying or more political activities have you done in the past?
Yep.
And then, like, what's your general approach to how you think about this? What are the areas of influence over, you know, we'll focus on U.S. policy that you're most, or politics, that you'd be most excited by?
Sure. So I think when it comes to policy change, I think that a lot of people who haven't, you know, done philanthropy in this area before can be surprised at just like how many different things there are to do and how they all fit together to increase the odds of policy change. So I think, you know, a lot of people, when they talk about policy change, they imagine electioneering, they imagine donating to someone's campaign, or they imagine sort of quid pro quo lobbying. So, you know, here's a donation, now do this. And I, you know, those are some two of the issues we think least about, I would say, in terms of trying to accomplish policy change. So I think some of the, you know, I have in my head kind of a policy change pipeline. There's kind of the early stage work and the late stage work, kind of like a drug development pipeline. So there's, you know, there's academic research, which is coming up with new ways of thinking about policy, new ideas that can affect the policy discussion. And certainly people have credited neoliberals and conservatives with getting very far on that over the past several decades. And that's, you know, that's a philanthropic, nonprofit, and very long-term endeavor that doesn't really look like a power play, but it can matter a lot. Then you kind of go one level more applied, and you have these think tanks that say, here is an idea. How can we craft, you know, a bill or a policy proposal or a, you know, a practical way of setting up the law that would embody this idea? And there's think tanks at different levels of sort of being more academic and trying to think about what kinds of policy structures would be cool. And then there's think tanks that really try to push, you know, really like skeleton bills or principles. And then when you have something that you want to happen, you have advocacy. And, you know, I don't think with the way things are set up that kind of like trading donations for legislation is, you know, it to me, it's not the most interesting thing to think about or the most important thing. People care. A lot of times people are more likely to pass a bill, A, when they understand the pros and cons, and B, when they feel that their constituents care, when they feel that lots of people with lots of votes care. And that leads to two different kinds of lobbying. Grass tops lobbying, which a lot of it is just about helping people. There's just the bills are so complex and there's so much to know that if you can just be a credible voice on what a bill does and what the pros and cons are, you can help your allies know what to do and what to push for. And then grassroots is organizing and bringing together lots and lots of people who might care about an issue, but nobody's grabbed their attention. Nobody's pulled them together around an action. And so those can make things dramatically more likely. And then there's a whole bunch of other things. So, you know, in criminal justice reform, we believe a lot of the problem, a lot of the reason the U.S., in our view, over-incarcerates people, it's not just what the sentencing laws say, it's the prosecutors. And prosecutors have a lot of discretion. So, you know, a prosecutor decides what kind of sentence they're going to ask for and who they're going to go after. And if a prosecutor, if their whole culture is being tough on crime and their whole self-conception of what it means to be a good prosecutor is locking up lots of people and being tough, you get one world. If there's another conception that says, I am serving my community, we don't want people to suffer in prison and we don't want to pay for it either if there's not a good reason, and I want to help my community broadly, that's another culture. And so changing the culture of prosecutors is an example of something we think could change policy outcomes a lot. It's not legislation. It's not the same kind of thing. And so that leads to a whole other set of interventions. So, you know, my bottom line is there's a whole set of things you can do, and they can fit together in complex ways. And our approach has been we've got to pick the best issues to work on. We've got to pick the issues where we really want to go in. We think we can get some wins. and or we think the wins would be really worthwhile. And then we've got to have someone who specializes it and lives and breathes that issue and knows how to put together all these pieces and see what's missing. And that is the role that, in many cases, our program officers are playing.
Oh, good answer. Okay, another question from the audience is about blind spots.
Yep.
What do you think... Maybe this is impossible to answer, but what do you think are the blind spots of OpenPhil or the blind spots of EA?
Yeah, well, it's hard to, definitely hard to answer a question about my own blind spots. So what do I think? I mean, certainly I would say that as an institution, with like a lot of people trying to coordinate together, there are things that we have more trouble seeing than an individual might see. So I think certainly, you know, a lot of times projects that are smaller are harder for us. Like, we have to engage with them to understand them, and we're less likely to do it. So I think we can miss a lot of good small things. I think projects that have risks, especially reputational risks, like, if the grant is good enough, if the impact is good enough, we will take on any amount of reputational risk. If the grant is good and the PR risk is manageable, we will take that on. But, you know, I think that we do look at, you know, what is going on in the media and how people might react to things and how that's going to affect our reputation, and not everything that we contemplate is worth it. And so I think that, you know, as an institution, there are things that are maybe harder for us to do as quickly and as confidently as, let's say, an individual donor who is obsessed with some corner of the world that we don't know very well and is able to do it. I mean, well, a much more obvious blind spot for us: we have focus areas. We don't, you know, we are very deliberate about this. We like to pick things to care about, become really, really knowledgeable about them, and then be able to make quick and bold and good decisions about them. But that means we have to pick. And so if some grant comes out of nowhere and it's not the kind of thing we usually think about, we've tried to choose those well, but we're not as good at evaluating those grants. And if there's something that's not a focus area that you know a lot about, then you're probably sitting in our blind spot and you should probably, you know, do something good. So yeah, so those are some answers to that.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So we'll change tack a little bit, and then say you've made risks from advanced artificial intelligence a key focus area at the moment. And so tell us a little bit about how you see AI developing over the coming decades, what your timelines for development of artificial general intelligence or transformative AI might be. How do you see that landscape?
Yeah, this is a tough topic to cover succinctly. And definitely, you know, last year I put a lot of work into two very long posts and still felt that we had been very superficial about it. So I'm going to do what I can in a few minutes. Basically, you know, I guess premise one is that it seems like it ought to be possible in principle to build an algorithm or an AI that sort of can outperform humans at very important intellectual tasks. It doesn't have to be all tasks. And so we call this transformative AI, and I guess part of this premise is the idea that humans dominate the planet and have shaped, you know, everything going on Earth more than other animals, not because we're strong, but because of our intelligence and because of the ideas we have. And so intelligence is power. And so, you know, in at some point, it seems like it should be possible to build an AI that is able to take the kinds of things humans have done that have made us most powerful and in some ways most scary, like developing nuclear weapons, and do that better than humans can. So that's kind of premise one, obviously debatable, but it's something I definitely believe. Premise two is that it might happen on the soon side. So that is, you know, we have tried it's very, very hard to make predictions about the long-term future. It's certainly the case that there's nothing close today to an AI that could develop, you know, a new kind of weapon or something on its own using kind of creative scientific research. But I think it's possible, and our best guess is that there's a reasonable probability this happens within the next 20 years. So last year I said at least 10% in the next 20 years. This year I'm saying at least 10% in the next 19 years. I usually don't get into more detail than that because my views move around a lot, and I think 10% is enough. For someone like us, we're doing hits-based giving. When you think about the kind of dramatic transformation the world might undergo if for the first time ever you had something that was superhuman at the key intellectual tasks, I think that a 10% chance of that is enough to take really, really seriously and sort of act as if it's 100% and see what happens. And so that's premise two. And then premise three is that there are risks, that this won't necessarily go great. that it isn't necessarily on us to just make this happen as soon as possible. But there are ways that the development of this kind of AI could be really bad. Solace 3. One risk I think of is what we sometimes call misuse risk. So that would be the idea that if this kind of AI were developed very quickly, then it could lead to a concentration of power. And if that concentration of power happened in the wrong hands, that could be just kind of astronomically bad for the world. I think the analogy there would be that the U.S. got a big advantage at one point because we had sort of more brain power than other countries, which led to us having completely different kinds of weapons. And that's a kind of thing that could happen again and in a more dramatic and extreme way. So that's a risk. Risk number two is what people call the alignment problem, what Nick Bostrom wrote about in the book Superintelligence. And this is that you might also, even if people are well-meaning, when you have something that powerful and that intelligent, the consequences of screwing up the coding in a certain way could be much worse than you normally see with automated systems today, because the stakes could be much higher. The thing could be much more autonomous, much more powerful. The example I sometimes give is current AI paradigms. You give an AI a very well-defined, algorithmically precise, measurable goal, and it will learn whatever it needs to learn to achieve that goal. So if it's a video game and it gets points, it will learn how to understand the screen and break it down and come up with strategies to get those points. And you can imagine a world where AIs are much more broad and creative and powerful, but they still need that very measurable goal. And that would be sort of a scary world because, for example, you and I might be sitting here and we might be thinking, well, if I get this AI to maximize the amount of money in a certain bank account, it will probably be able to do that in a sense. But that could be really bad. Like, that could go really badly. Because it could, you could imagine very extreme and illegal, et cetera, measures that happen to do that sort of thing. And you could even imagine in the extreme, a very literal AI could try and have a goal of sort of making all available resources in the world into something that's kind of representing this bank account going up. So let's not do that. What I'd rather do is have an AI that keeps the world safe from that problem. Maximizing the money in a bank account is a much better defined goal than keeping us safe from AIs that want to maximize the money in a bank account. And so the risk I think we see is of, an AI that is very smart, but that is also very literal. And I think we sometimes refer to that as the alignment problem. And the third risk is kind of the interaction of the two. So if you and I are both working on an AI, happens all the time, and I'm thinking,
we've got an unfriendly AI in the basement.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I have this thing. It would be dangerous and risky to use it. I wish I could get better at making it safe to use, but if I wait too long, Will might use his thing to take over the world, so I should really move first. I think that is a very bad situation that could lead to sort of an adversarial dynamic and a lot of carelessness that could really amplify both kinds of risks. So that is kind of how we see the AI world, and in terms of what we're trying to do about it, I'd break it down by problem. So I'd say on the alignment problem, we might be better off if we got a head start on thinking about what would it look like to build an AI that could learn kind of the very fuzzy, poorly defined goals of humans. So a paper that came out of OpenAI pretty recently, people were trying to train a simulated robot to do a backflip. And a backflip is kind of a poorly defined idea. And so the way they did it was by having it take random actions and producing two videos of itself that it would show to an actual human. And the human would say, that one, warmer. And they do that a lot. And then the thing learns to do a backflip. And so, this sort of research on how can we build AIs that can take sort of poorly defined goals and try to pursue them and learn them without screwing anything up too badly, that is a field we're trying to grow, and we're supporting a whole bunch of professors and researchers and trying to encourage them and support them to do that kind of research. And then on the other issues I talked about, the problems with adversarial dynamics, I think we'd be safer if we at least had some kind of ideal case, some kind of what do we hope happens if and when powerful AI comes and if and when it comes suddenly. What do we hope people will do? Like, who has kind of the moral and legal authority to launch an AI that could be very powerful and very dangerous? And what do they have the moral and legal authority to do with that? And so that's what we call you know, AI strategy, a lot of the most important part, in our opinion, is that kind of question. And so we've been trying to find people to support to work on that and to kind of develop plans that make sense for different scenarios and make those plans more likely to come about. This is a great example of hits-based giving. We could easily fund this work, put a ton of money in for decades, and never see any output at all. And on the other hand, you know, if this work has an impact, it's hard to get a bigger impact than that.
Okay, and then in terms of the, you spoke of misuse, misaligned values or goals, and then kind of arms race dynamics.
Yeah.
How likely do you think each of these, you know, in terms of size of the risks, how likely are each of these, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, this is a hugely debatable issue, and one of the frustrating things for me is that even people who think a lot about AI risk, they're just all over the place on how big these risks are. I mean, I think I can show you really smart, thoughtful people who've thought about it a ton who will put alignment risk, the risk of a really bad sort of, you know, catastrophic for the future of humanity alignment risk problem. People will put it at 5% or below, and people will put it at like 90% and above. And so that is a place where I would love to converge. I definitely fall on the lower end of that spectrum for my own impressions, my own guesses, but that doesn't necessarily matter that much. 5% would still be an awful lot when you think about something that is sort of more powerful intelligence than humans and wants something that we don't want. So I do think the misuse stuff is more likely than that, but maybe easier to recover from in the long run. And so I think both risks deserve just a ton of attention.
Cool. And so then for people who are kind of concerned about this issue, want to get more involved in it, what do you think kind of skills should be learning, pitfalls to avoid? What sort of people do we need most right now, do you think?
Sure. So the people we're most excited to fund, I would say, one would be top, you know, really sort of elite culture-shaping technical researchers who want to work on some of these problems, like the alignment problem. If I wanted to be one of those, I would get an ML PhD, follow the normal path, and see if I could be, an outlier performer there. Two, like I mentioned, people who can think through more the political science and the strategy of, you know, what would this situation look like and what do we hope it looks like if there's a quick development of a powerful AI? And so for that, I think that's such a nascent field that I really would talk to effective altruists and just ask them, you know, what's going on and how you might fit in and what they think, you know, needs doing. So good people to talk to, Michael Page, Alan Defoe, Luke Muehlhauser, who works for OpenPhil. So I think those, you know, those are two really big ones. I also think that people who can be in positions where they'll be part of important decisions that get made, for example, working for the government in the relevant agencies, who care deeply about these problems and who kind of are focused on the interests of humanity as a whole, I think that would be really great. And so I think anyone who, you know, I know the people we do know who are effective altruists in government are begging for more effective altruists to go into government. I really strongly advocate for that for anyone who thinks they might be interested in doing it. And a final one, I think more clarity on this debate about when we might expect a powerful AI to be developed, what the timeline is there, what the probabilities are. That would be, if there were someone who spent all day, every day on that question, that would be really cool. And I don't know of any such thing today.
Okay, cool. And then on a topic, related question then, the way, for my kind of impressions from AI and so on, it made me have this kind of update of thinking, you know, there can be causes where most actions are bad. Most things you can do in this area just make things worse. And the analogy I use is someone gets hit by a bus and they're on the road and there's already a big crowd of people and you see it. Should you like run in and try and help, or is the best thing you can do just to kind of walk by? And I kind of wondered with AI, like, can this be one of these areas where there's more, you know, the average action adds more noise than value? And that would be then a worry for EA community if suddenly it's like, oh, AI is this big new cause area, a lot of people think it's really important, and this army of people who maybe, for whom it's not the best fit, kind of goes in. Do you think that's something we should be worried about, or?
Yeah, I do worry about that. I think it's kind of true that at least everything I can think of, every action you can take on AI has at least like some sort of downside. You know, I think it's a cause where people are sort of debating what to focus on and debating what to do. And a lot of it is about trying to find the best thing and focus on that. But it's, I don't think there's a lot of actions that are just like obviously good. You know, there are some organizations that I think are good that donating to them is good. But In terms of taking action, I think it's tough to find that. So, yeah, I mean, I think it might have been different a few years ago when no one ever acknowledged that AI risk was an issue at all. And a lot of people were saying, what's something I can do, anything, to get anyone to pay attention to this? But I think that's not the world right now. And so I do really think that it would be a mistake if you're interested in AI safety to just jump in and start advocating or doing things directly at AI safety. I would really, anyone who wants to work in this area, yeah, I think it's worth becoming, you know, getting deep skills and a deep network and having good people you can go to for good advice, and really focusing on being in a good position with a good network, with, you know, good skills and all that, before you're really focused on, okay, what am I going to do now to reduce risks? That's my own perspective on it. And I think OpenPhil is fortunate to be in that position. We do know a lot of the people who've been thinking about these issues the longest, and we check in with people like crazy on just about everything we do.
Cool. And so last kind of question on AI then is, you recently made a big grant to OpenAI. Tell us firstly about kind of reasoning behind that grant, what your relationship will be like going forward. And then, again, as a question from the audience, you got some criticism in the light of making that grant with respect to relationship disclosures, the substance of it, communication, and so on. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you respond to that? Those worries or criticisms as well?
Sure. So there's a lot to go into here. OpenAI is one of our biggest bets. It's, you know, financially our biggest bet so far in AI. I think it is a great example of just, like, a very risky, hard-to-evaluate grant. I think it is absolutely worth it. I think it is super high impact and expectation, and it touches on all the areas we talked about. So, you know, on the technical research side, we want technical research to grow as a field. We want more people working on safety. But the thing is, we fund academics. We're becoming increasingly aware that industry is where the most prestigious career paths are in a lot of people's eyes. And so when AI researchers think about what they want to work on, they do want to think about what the jobs are and what industry is interested in. And as a matter of normality, we can't fund industry. They won't take our money, and, you know, they're not looking for it, and, you know, they have different incentives. And so the opportunity to take, you know, I think OpenAI did an amazing job and really surprised me with how fast they were able to recruit top talent and just enter the conversation immediately as one of the first organizations anyone says as, like, who's a leading edge industry AI lab? Who's got the best talent? They're right up there. Having the opportunity to get a board seat at that organization, and to encourage that organization to put more resources and more energy into this safety research, I think is, like, something very unique. And I don't know how else we could have gotten that chance to have a cultural impact there. I think on the strategy side, you know, certainly I think OpenAI could be a good place for someone to work who is thinking about what I called the deployment problem. So I'm going to think about what is the ideal outcome, because I think if and when we end up in one of these difficult situations, I think a lot of what happens is going to be shaped by whatever labs are on the frontier. So when policymakers, when governments are trying to decide what to do, who should launch AI, how, and what properties it has, it's going to be those labs shaping the conversation. And so I think, A, OpenAI ought to have, you know, someone who is a really serious, dedicated advisor and scholar on these issues and has the best answers available. And B, I think OpenAI provides an environment where there's actual practical demand for what that person is doing. And OpenAI makes decisions today that could bear on this later situation we find ourselves in. So, you know, what is the right level of information security for a lab today? What is the right policy for who could be a donor and what kind of access to information they get? You know, what is the right policy on background checks, things like that. So I think there's a whole bunch and on openness, actually, which is something that they got a lot of criticism for, that I was sympathetic to, is, you know, do you always want to be open or not? And or are there risks to that? So I think they are making a lot of directly relevant decisions. I think they're a good place for someone to think about that. And I think they're a leader on the culture of technical research. So, you know, We definitely saw that as a great opportunity to get a board seat at that organization. And it's also a grant where it's not just money. I spent a ton of time on this grant because we are very engaged. We're very involved. You know, our basic feeling is that OpenAI has done a phenomenal job getting to the front edge of capabilities, and their leadership has great values, wants the best for humanity. But we do not agree with everything they've done and everything they've said on the tactics and how you achieve those values. And so to us, that's kind of the sweet spot of where it might work to be a very active donor and to be a consistent voice to say, we're a large donor, we're a board member, and we are going to try and bridge OpenAI's leadership with the effective altruist community, the people who we think the hardest about the safety issues. That feels very worth it to us. So those are, you know, those are the things it has going for it, but it will be hard to say anything. And certainly, you know, it'll be hard to say anything about what the impact was and about, you know, how much of what happened was OpenAI versus our influence. That's not a question we're really going to try to answer. Instead, we're just going to ask in, you know, 3 years when the grant is up, we're going to say, is OpenAI an amazing role model? Are they on the frontier of AI research and also doing everything on safety they reasonably can and everyone can see it? And if the answer to that is yes, then for the time being, we're going to say that grant is going well, and we're going to renew it. And I think that creates the right situation for having an impact. But it's, you know, it's going to be a tough one to assess. And it's a perfect example of a grant that certainly got us a lot of flack online, didn't get us a lot of praise online. That's fine. You know, and is going to be tough for us to ever come out and say, hey, here's evidence that it was good, even to ourselves or to the public. And that's just what we're doing. I mean, we think it's an incredibly high impact grant and we're taking the chance. With respect to the relationships and the disclosures, we have a lot of ties to OpenAI. And frankly, if we didn't, I would be a lot more pessimistic. I think it is a tough dynamic. We usually do not try to be an active funder. It is hard with a grantee. You're going, as a funder, you're going to make suggestions, and the grantee will have too much incentive to do what you say, even if they don't really think it's a good idea. And that can be a very toxic dynamic. And so, I think this is a naturally high-risk grant in that sense as well. And I think it is absolutely the case that we have strong ties to OpenAI. So two of their researchers live in a house with me. One of them is my future brother-in-law. He was one of Gibwell's first fans, introduced me to his sister, and we all have a lot in common. And so we've chosen to spend a lot of time together. And when we put that up on a website, I think a couple things happened. One, people made the totally valid point, hey, this could be a conflict of interest. I should say that we communicated badly, because this guy and the other guy, that's two out of about 60 people at OpenAI. So it's not, you know, this wasn't a grant to him. But I certainly understand how people could look at this and say, boy, like, this grant doesn't look to me like it was made for the right reasons. And I basically, you know, can only say all the decision makers involved knew about this and were fully involved and were paying attention and had to make for themselves a decision. I've seen this relationship. I know this relationship. Do I think this grant is about this relationship, or do I think this grant is about impact? And I think that was a question that our funders were totally well positioned to answer. And people reading on the internet do not have much to go on there and do not have much to work with. And so I don't really expect them to believe me when I say, you know, what the purpose for the grant was. I mean, they can or they cannot. And so that's what it does. And I think in the future, I think we need to revise the way we do these disclosures, because I think it sort of gave the impression as if we were promoting this organization to the general public and kind of telling them something they needed to know. And rather it was just kind of an FYI. And I think the bigger conversations about it were the ones that took place internally.
Okay, fantastic. And so, just got a few minutes left, so I'll kind of bundle the last two questions that I want to ask, and you can answer them together or separately. And
sure.
Those two questions are then, firstly, just for someone who's thinking OpenPhil seems like a really great organization to have a big impact, but maybe they're in college at the moment and it's a kind of aspiring place where they'd want to work.
Yep.
What could they be doing now in order to increase their chances of working there or figuring out if it's a good fit? Second question then is, what projects do you wish you could see in the world? Maybe we've got some entrepreneurially minded people or people further along thinking about what they could be doing. What sort of projects would you love to see?
Yeah, so first off, on what people can do if they're in college, they're trying to become the kind of person who could be an OpenPhil employee. So an obvious thing is being an expert in one of our areas, really getting obsessed with farm animal welfare or biosecurity or criminal justice or AI. Certainly, but then I would say also a more general thing would be OpenPhil is partly defined by a certain approach to knowledge and reasoning and epistemology that really is kind of copied over from GiveWell, or like takes GiveWell as a starting point. There may be some modifications to accommodate more risks. But a lot of the best generalists at OpenPhil started at GiveWell, got their training there, were outstanding performers there. And I think that epistemology, the easiest way to pick it up is to take some topic, some debate, where people are claiming there's a study on one side, there's a study on the other side, and try to just figure it out yourself so that you're not, you know, your opinion is not based on anyone else's opinion. You've gone to the ground truth. If there's a study, instead of saying, that study looks impressive, you said, okay, how many people were in this study? Did they randomize? What did they do? What are the critiques of this study? How might it have been misleading? And you just get all the way into it and then write up what you think and what you concluded in a way that is nuanced and clear. Because the thing that really we look for in OpenPhil employees is when I ask you a question and you say what you think, I know what you're saying and I know why you think it. And it's not kind of this, you know, this emotive mood assertion that you see in a lot of public discourse today, but it's a much more precise and transparent, you know, let's all be open with each other about the pros and cons of the course of action we're considering. And I think that GiveWell is a great, like, just looking at GiveWell, that's like a good place to pick that up. GiveWell poses a lot more detail on their thinking than we do. And so just even, you know, in addition to working there, I think even reading just the website in all its detail and trying to say, I don't trust GiveWell at all. Let me decide what I think based on reading what they say and following whatever footnotes I need to follow, I think would position you well. And then on what projects I want to see, I'll give a kind of related answer, because I earlier mentioned a bunch of cause-related projects. Certainly wish there were more AI strategy folks, more biosecurity folks focused on the worst risks, more folks interested in animal behavior. But again, a more general type of project I would like to see is someone who can sort through debates and help distill them down. Because I think, you know, today the main home for intellectuals is academia, and academia's culture is really all about breaking new ground. It's all about innovating and thinking about ways no one's ever done it before. And I think there's a different kind of intellectual work that has no institutional home. And that is when you already have a zillion studies and you're drowning in them and everyone is claiming this and that. You can always, everyone can cite a study supporting their position. But what would actually believe if you read all the studies and understood all the studies? And is there anyone who's doing that critical work and helping people sort through all the information that's out there, not breaking new ground, not having new insights, but just saying, this is what's out there, and I'm going to help break it down and distill it and critically analyze it so that we can use it for decision making? I think that's a general category, and generally any question I have, whether it's, you know, should I floss or, you know, what, how effective is deworming? It's like my choices are kind of spend hundreds of hours reading papers or hope that Slate Star Codex puts up a 75-page blog post, or hope that it happens to be a GiveWell topic. Those are most of my options. And so, you know, I think it's tough, and I wish there were more people who are kind of really devoted to critical evidence reviews and distillation of the knowledge that's already out there. And there's not much of an institutional home for it, but there is a funder for it. So, yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Okay, on that note, let us all thank Holden. That was super interesting, I think.
Cool, thanks.